Good morning, and thank you for coming to what is the last of this year's medical ethics, medical halacha sessions here at the Bayit. Actually, the ones in Shari Shemayim wrapped up first, so it's the last one for this programming year. Altogether, we continue, God willing, after the summer. I am looking for ideas for next year. So afterwards, when I send my follow-up email, I expect to also send a request for topics for next year. I already have quite a few that have been submitted, but I'm always looking for more. Actually, I may end up doing a fertility treatments part two next year, because I had all sorts of ideas for what I would cover in this one, and realized that I need to spend just a lot of time on the basics, so that this will be sort of the intro one, and then we'll do a more advanced one perhaps next year. That will be more advanced. Please make sure that you sign in. As always, certainly if you want to get credit for it, CME credit, but also I like to send out email afterwards on items, following up items from the class, and notifications for future sessions. If you have a cell phone and you could please put it on silent or vibrate or something along those lines, that will be helpful. And last but not least, in my introductory items, God willing, I will be sending out an evaluation, online evaluation form by email afterwards as part of the follow-up. Even if you're not a medical professional, if you could please fill it out, there are like 5 questions, and it's important for us to be able to get accreditation for these classes. So please do so. The topic for this morning, fertility treatments in Jewish law. I want to point out to you a book which I'm going to refer to several times in the course of the next hour and a quarter, hour 20 minutes. And this is called Shut Pua in Hebrew. It is in Hebrew. The book is in Hebrew. It's from Machon Pua in Israel. I'll put it on the video. The Machon Pua is Israel's leading, as far as I know, fertility institute. Not that I'm an expert, but it seems like it's the leading institute for fertility and Jewish law. They are really remarkable. I've known of them for, I think, the last basically 15 years, since when I was in my shul in Pennsylvania, they sent somebody to come speak. They are truly remarkable in dealing with issues of, like it sounds, halacha and fertility. And they put out this book called Shut Pua, Responsa from Pua. The name Pua, I hope people are familiar in terms of where it comes from. She's, you know, Shifra and Pua, the midwives in Egypt. But what they do when they have questions, and the questions range from the fundamental to the very technical and sophisticated, they take their questions to about a dozen leading rabbis, mostly in Israel, and in the chapters here, they record what each of them said with sources and footnotes and everything, so that it's a very good resource to be able to use, certainly if someone has technical issues, but also for somebody who just wants to know what's going on in the Jewish world. How are we dealing with these issues of new technologies and new medical issues? So this can be an incredible resource. I do not make anything off of the sale of the book. This isn't even my copy. This is Rabbi Ziering's copy. But please do consider that if this is a topic of interest to you. I think it's very important. So I structured the class for today around 5 questions. 2 general questions and then 3 vignettes. You can see them at the top of the sheet, on the top of the first side. The first 2 questions are broad introductory questions. How important is procreation as a mitzvah in terms of overriding other halachic considerations to pursue it? All the sheets that I have are right there in the middle on the first side, right with the sign-in, where the sign-in sheets are. If they're gone, then that means we finished them. Some over there. Okay. So the first question is, how important is this mitzvah of producing children? And the reason this is going to matter is because we're going to talk about the question of whether a couple is obligated to pursue these sorts of interventions. And we're going to talk about the question of pursuing interventions on Shabbos in ways which may run counter to elements of Jewish law. So we need to know just how big is this mitzvah? Where is it on the scale of the halachic calculus? That's one That's one introductory question. The other one is, are artificial insemination and in vitro fertilization acceptable within halakha, right? The artificial insemination where they take the seed from the male and then they're going to put it into the woman and the fertilization will take place inside of her, versus in vitro fertilization in which they're taking the sperm from the man and the egg from the woman and they're fertilizing outside of her and then they're going to put it into the uterus. There are all sorts of refinements on both of those in terms of methods. I'm not going there in this session. But the question is, are these acceptable within halacha? And that's really important because I think there is a tendency to sort of take it as a given. Like, oh, of course these are okay. We want to produce children. The only question is how, and can I do it on Shabbos versus on Tuesday? But actually, this is a very, very serious halachic debate, which we're going to see a piece of, I hope, today. And that's our second introductory question. Then, when we get past those, we'll deal with three particular practical cases. The first one I made up in number three. Numbers four and five are actually just translations of questions that are found in this Shut Pua book, as you'll see. But let's get started first on the introductory questions. The halachic status of the mitzvah of producing children. So we're told right in the beginning of the Torah that God wants us to reproduce. It's the very first thing we know about what Hashem wants is pruravu, bear fruit and multiply. Right? That's the very first thing we know about Hashem. Really, we know it even before that because He creates life, and that tells us something about what He values. But that's right there at the outset as a very important mitzvah. It is indeed the first in the 613 that are cataloged in the Sefer HaChinuch, where He gives you the catalog of the 613 mitzvot. Versions of this mitzvah apply for Jews as well as for non-Jews, it seems. More than that, it has the status in halacha of what's called a mitzvah rabbah. Not just a mitzvah, but a great mitzvah. And this comes up in a context which may seem a little bit strange and esoteric. But that's the way it goes in halacha. You have to know the strange and the esoteric. It is insufficient to just know the basics and the general. You won't get all the interesting material. So here we go with something that certainly qualifies on the esoteric front. It's a Mishnah in Gittin in source number one, dealing with the case of someone who is described as Chetzio Eved Chetzio Ben Chorin. Half slave, half free. The concept of slavery in the Torah is way beyond anything we're going to discuss right now. That's just not on the table. There are too many other things that we have to discuss. Take it as a given that there is indeed such a concept, as hard as it is for our 21st century ears to hear, there is a concept of somebody saying, I'm going to sell my freedom in order that I should be able to survive financially, and for a period of time I will be an Eved, I will be a slave. That exists among Jews, it exists among non-Jews. So let's say you have the following scenario. You have somebody who is an Eved, he's a slave, owned by two masters at once. There are two people who own the Eved simultaneously. And that can happen in a variety of ways. Simplest way would be that somebody passes away and leaves the Eved in his estate to the heirs. Eved Kanani in such a case, correct. So the Eved Kanani is left to the estate, and there are two kids who now have a shared Eved. So let's say one of them frees his half. What's the status of the Eved now? And the answer is that this Eved is a half and half. He is half Eved, he is half free. And the Mishnah deals with what that means in practice. Misha chetzio Eved v'chetzio ben chorin. If somebody is half Eved, half free, Ovid is rabo yom echad ves atzmo yom echad divrei beis Hillel. Beis Hillel says, I guess that means he has half the week off. Right? He's not going to be an Eved on Shabbos anyway. But during the week, 3 days he's an Eved, 3 days he's not an Eved. Beis Shammai looks at Beis Hillel and says, are you sure? Tikantem es rabo ves atzmo lo tikantem. You've taken care of his master. In other words, now I know for whom he has to work on which days. But you haven't taken care of him because he can't get married. We're assuming we're dealing with a male here. Lisa shivcha iefshar shekvar chetzio ben chorin. He can't marry a maid, meaning a female Eved, can't do that because half of him is free, and a free person is not allowed to marry an Eved or to marry a shivcha. So that doesn't work. But he can't marry a free woman either because half of him is an Eved, and the Eved is not allowed to marry a free woman. So he is stuck. Yibatel, should we say, well, that's just too bad? bad. That's the price of being an Eved, and therefore he can't participate. Va'alolo nivraha olam el piri v'rivya. The world was created for procreation. Shenemar, as the pasuk says, lo sohu bra'a la'sheves yitzara. He did not create it to be empty. He did not create it for nothing. God created the world in order for it to be settled. That's the objection of Beis Shammai. So the answer is, you know what we do? We force the master, we force the remaining master who owns half of his eved to free him. That's what we do. Kofinus Rabo Va'osa Noso Ben Chorin, and he writes up a document saying, I owe you for half of the slave market value of the eved, because after all, the adon, the master, is out his ownership of his stake in the eved. And Beis Shammai says, you know, you're right. And they go back to follow Beis Shammai. So the Eved goes free. In order that he should be able to marry, in order that he should be able to have children. That's the Mishnah in Gittin. And again, I would love to discuss this case in greater depth. It's very interesting in terms of insights it gives us on a whole host of levels. But we're not going to, because we have like 30 more sources to see. So that's the Mishnah. Do you notice something strange, though, about the argument the Mishnah made? There's something strange about the argument that it made when it talked about why you should free this Eved. Yeah?
They said Jeraviyah, but they don't quote the Pasuk.
Yeah, they gave me the wrong Pasuk. They gave me the wrong verse. They're telling me how important it is. The world was only created for procreation, but I'm going to skip Bereishis, where God says pru or vu, and I'm going to jump all the way into the Navi, into the prophets, to Yeshaya, to give you a pasuk that says God wanted the world to be settled. That's why he created it. I don't understand. What happened? Why didn't you just use the pasuk I would have used? So source number two, Tosfos, the anthology of commentaries you see, I try to give you the 12th to 13th century Western Europe is a rough approximation for when this is from. Tosfos says in source number two, Hadalonaka kra de pru uravu, the reason why it didn't use the verse of bear fruit and multiply, the standard one, Mishum de'iha v'yachol akayim sheves kolduhu Mishum mitzvahs puruvu avakafinam lay. I added the word babduso in the brackets. He says, because there are multiple levels to fulfilling the mitzvah of procreation. There is the mitzvah found in the beginning of the Torah of bear fruit and multiply. However, there's a broader mitzvah, which is found in Yeshaya, in that other verse in Isaiah, which says that God wants the world to be settled, and that's the mitzvah called Shevet. And really, as a slave, even if he can't fulfill Pru or Avu, if hypothetically we had a halachically permissible way for him to get married and have a child, really it's the issue of halachically having a child, then we would call that fulfillment of Shevet, even if not Puruvu. In other words, an Eved can't fulfill Puruvu, cannot fulfill bear fruit and multiply. However, he can fulfill Shevet, theoretically. That's the argument we wish to make. And therefore, what we would have done, as you would have said, if he could fulfill Shevet as an Eved, as a slave, we would say, let him stay in that position. Don't free him. We would not compel him in order to fulfill bear fruit and multiply. This more basic level of Shevet would still apply to him as an Eved. And what the Gemara is saying is, bless you, what the Mishnah is saying is, he can't even do Shevet in this status as a half-Eved, half-free person. Why? Because he can't marry the Shifcha with whom he would have fulfilled Shevet as a slave, and he can't marry the free person with whom he would have fulfilled Pru Revu as a free person, therefore you have to free him. So the novelty here, the point that Tosfos reads into the Mishnah is that that Shevet is sort of the least common denominator, and if he could have done that, that would have been sufficient. But then Tosfos goes on and says, that's only my first answer. And the second answer is really the one we want. Inami, alternatively, if you're using the English, it's where I wrote or at the end of the second line of the translation. Or, Nakat haikra mishum demukha demitzvah rabbi. It cited this verse in particular because its language shows that this is a great mitzvah. Meaning it's one thing in the beginning of the Torah for God to say, I would like you to reproduce. It's another thing to have a sentence in Yeshaya, in Isaiah, where he says that I created this world to be settled. It's a much stronger statement of the divine will. It says, this is why I created the world. I created the world for it to be settled. Ask me later about population explosions. But that's what he says. I want there to be life here. And that's a stronger statement of what God wants. And that converts this from mitzvah, I have a whole host of mitzvahs, to mitzvah rabbah, to a grand mitzvah, to something which will have a halachic weight to actually override other considerations, as we are going to see. That's what Tosfos says, and he proves it to you by quoting you a Gemara in Megillah, which says that you would sell a Sefer Torah in order to be able to marry somebody off so that they should be able to procreate. If you have the case, classically, these cases involve yesomim, children who did not have parents. It was always financially difficult for them to be able to get married. They did not have somebody to provide the dowry, the gifts that normally would come into the marriage. And so the Gemara says, normally you can't sell a Sefer Torah for anything. Normally, selling a Sefer Torah is a very severe no-no. However, for certain mitzvos you're able to. One is for the sake of Talmud Torah, for the sake of Torah study. You can sell the Torah in order to be able to learn Torah. And the other case is this one, in order to be able to marry them off. Then we would use those funds in order to be able to pay for them to get married. So, yeah.
But they don't understand the difference between Shabbat and Puru Avu.
So, it's really just the fact that Puru Avu, to bear fruit and multiply, is the imperative given in the beginning of the Torah, whereas Shabbat is the phrasing of it for the in Yeshaya. But the difference from it in practice will be that Puru Avu, because it's a mitzvah that's not listed among the seven Noahide ones, is normally assumed to apply specifically to Jews. Whereas Shevet, this idea that God wants the world settled, is not just about Jews, that's about humanity overall, and therefore it applies for non-Jews and this Evet as well. That's the distinction.
Except that Puru Avu is given before there are Jews or...
Right. Right. So the Gemara discusses the status of mitzvos which appear in the beginning of the Torah and are repeated after the Torah is given or are not repeated after the Torah is given. So to distinguish, we don't find Puru Avu stated again in the Chumash after the beginning. However, we find Bris Mila stated initially for Avraham and then repeated in Parashas Tazria. So there are distinctions that are drawn based on that in terms of who they will apply to, what the scope of the mitzvah will be, depending on whether they get repeated or don't get repeated. In this case, it's understood that this is not one of the Noahide laws, even though you are right, it is initially stated apparently for humanity as a whole. Yeah.
The Puru Avu appears to be just on the individuals, but he's just explaining to them, well, Shevet is... It's a communal obligation to facilitate the marriage of others.
That's a very important thought, which we're going to come back to in a couple of minutes. You can call yourself the Brisker Rav when we get there. But it's a very important point. Dr. Nussbaum.
How can you have a Mitzvah Rav with so specifically that we cannot measure one Mitzvah over another, so how can you classify one is a great one and one is a lesser.
That's a really good question. How can you start classifying mitzvot when the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says explicitly, be careful with all mitzvot, whether they are light or whether they are severe, doesn't make a difference, you don't know what the reward is. And the answer is, we do not judge mitzvot except when we do. We understand that God does give us certain ways to gauge. So, for example, a mitzvah that has a harsher penalty listed with it in the Torah for violating it is considered more severe than a mitzvah that has a lesser penalty associated with it. That's one example. Another example is the difference between a sin of commission and a sin of omission. Right? The difference between missing a mitzvah asay, I failed to pick up a lulav, I failed to say Shema in time, versus violating actively a los asay, eating non-kosher, let's say. So we understand that sinning by action is worse than sinning by omission. There are different ways in which we can prioritize mitzvot, and all that I understand in that Mishnah in Pirkei Avos is really two things. Number one, that I'm not supposed to say, this one seems to have greater reward, so I'm going to take this one. Right? I'm not supposed to choose the ones that have greater reward and ignore the others. And then I'm not supposed to say, this one really doesn't matter, we can discount this one because I guess this one is just not that important. You know, how important is Tachanun in the greater scheme of things? Now, you can't do that. To say, I don't consider this significant. It may be overridden by another halachic calculation. We're celebrating at a wedding. So therefore, we have a mitzvah of simcha, and therefore we're not going to say Tachanun. But it's not as though I get to dismiss it and say, well, this one just doesn't really matter to me. I think it's really more a matter of comparing one mitzvah to another when you have a halachic calculation to make, that's when we do it. So Tosfos says that we view procreation as a more powerful mitzvah. Rav Asher Weiss notes that other Rishonim, other early authorities, disagree with Tosfos about the explanation for why he used this verse. Even within Tosfos, we just saw two explanations. Nonetheless, it is generally understood that this is indeed a mitzvah rabba, a great mitzvah, and now I come back to Zev's point, it is a mitzvah for all Israel to perform. It's not only on the individual involved, because there's another Tosfos in this discussion, in source number 3. I'm going to say it outside of the text, and I may do that a lot in the interest of getting everything in today. So we'll see. But I always like you to have the material to be able to read it yourself. I think it's important. But Tosfos asks another question. When we're talking about forcing the master to free the eved, right, we are harming the master in two ways. Number one, financially. He had an eved and now he doesn't. And number two, there actually is a mitzvah regarding an eved kanani that he's supposed to keep the eved kanani. He is viewed as helping, in some sense, this Eved Kanani, who is now partially Jewish, partially not Jewish, not even the half and half case, but in general. There's a, in order to have an Eved Kanani, it's very important to know this rule. Now, maybe it's not practical, but it's still important to know this rule, that if one is going to have an Eved Kanani, the Eved Kanani has to, of his own will, underline that, of his own will, accept belief in God and in Torah and mitzvot. Even though he won't have the practice of mitzvot, he has to, of his own will, do that. And if he doesn't, you have to free him. You can't keep an eved against his will, and you can't keep him if he doesn't believe in it. And it's for a very simple reason: you don't want a Jewish household in which a major part of the household who's always there is somebody who believes in something different. It's not even from a humanitarian perspective. It's simply that this is a really bad idea. So that you have this. Eved here in your household. He's a believer now in the mitzvot. He even partially converts before becoming an eved, and then it's completed in the event that he becomes free. But the point here is that if the master has a mitzvah of not freeing this eved, right? How is it that you're now telling him to free the eved in order the eved should be able to do his mitzvah? It's the Eved's mitzvah, it's not my mitzvah. Why are you forcing me to do this? So that's Tosus' question in source number 3. And Tosus offers an answer. He says, Tosus says, we have a general rule that you don't say to somebody, you should sin, in order to save somebody else from sinning. The classic case in the Gemara in Shabbos. I see somebody on Friday afternoon stick dough into the oven, such that it's going to bake on Shabbos. Okay, that's what I see somebody do. Friday evening, he puts dough in the oven so that it's going to bake. I could take the dough out of the oven and save him from sinning by taking it out before it crusts over. I'll save him from violating a biblical mitzvah. However, there's a rabbinic prohibition against taking dough out of an oven on Shabbos. So what do? Do I violate a rabbinic mitzvah to keep someone from violating a biblical one? The Gemara in Shabbos says, no, you don't. That's his problem, that's not your problem. So Tosfos says, well, over here, why didn't you apply the same logic? And he says, well, it's different. Because in the case in the Gemara and Shabbos, they're assuming that this fellow sinned intentionally, or at least carelessly, by putting the dough in the oven. In the slave case, he's done nothing wrong. So that's Tosfos' answer, which is an important answer for other ramifications in Jewish law. However, the Briska Rav is quoted as giving a different answer in source number 4. The Briska Rav quoted by Rav Eliyahu Dushnitzer gives a fascinating answer. He says, you know what? The two questions we asked in Tosfos are connected. The question of why you used the verse for Shevet instead of the verse of Puravu, and the question of why are you having the master free him go together. He says, Puravu, and this goes back to Zev's point, Puravu is personal. Bear fruit and multiply is an imperative for each of us to do our best to be able to have children. I should underscore right now, I didn't say it in the very beginning, and I should have. This is not a mitzvah that is fulfilled by succeeding. a person, you know, in many situations, is not able to have children for whatever reason. We're told in the Gemara in Shabbos that Hashem is going to ask a person when they go to the next world six questions. Did you do this? Did you do this? Did you do this? Were you honest in business is your first question? Did you set up time to study Torah is your second question? And then you get a question of, did you involve yourself in procreation? The mitzvah is not, the question is not, did you succeed? The question is, did you make the attempt? That's a very important point that I really should have put in the very beginning, but at least I'll say it now. But pru urvu is a mitzvah of pru urvu is a mitzvah of the individual, that the individual should try to have children. Lasheves yitzara is a global mitzvah, that everyone should try to make sure that the world will be settled. It's a much more broad mitzvah. And taking that view, it's a mitzvah for the master also. It's the master's mitzvah too. So it brings me the verse of Shevet to tell me there's a broad mitzvah even on the master, and that's why the master has to free the Eved. Because he has to make sure to satisfy this imperative of filling the world with human beings.
What does settle actually mean?
What does settle actually mean?
Does it mean create a civilization or populate the world?
So that's a really good question also. It's a little bit beyond where I'm going to go right now. But the answer is it may well be broader than just having children. Because we talk about the issue of yeshuvo shel olam, of settling the world as an important halachic, as an important halachic value. And we talk about fulfilling this concept not only biologically through one's own children, but through adoption as well. So it's a broader thing than just reproduce your DNA. There's more to be said about it, but I'm not going to be able to address it here. There's actually a third mitzvah in terms of having children, which is La'erev al Tanach Yodecha, based on a pasuk in Koheles, to say that you should not stop, even in the evening, quote-unquote. You should continue to try to have children even after you have fulfilled the biblical minimum. Right? The mitzvah of Pru Revu, there's some debate in the Gemara as to when you fulfill it. Is it when you have one boy and one girl? Is it sufficient to have two of the same kind? And so on. There are different permutations that are offered. But there's a mitzvah as well of trying to have children even beyond that. So that's something that you should know as well. Although, as I note in source number 5 from Rav Wozner, we wouldn't say, according to most of us, we wouldn't say to sell a Torah for that purpose. That's a lesser imperative on the scale of things. Ari.
You said that Pru Revu is only said once. Do you mean before the Torah was given?
Yeah.
It says it to know as well.
Right, it's a good point. There actually, the truth of the matter is that I've been eliding the more sophisticated view of it, which is that the first time it appears, it's a bracha, and the second time, it's an imperative, or vice versa. But actually, yes, it does. What I meant was just pre-Sinai and post-Sinai. Was what I was getting at. So what we've established at this point is that producing children has the imperative of pru urvu, bear fruit and multiply, as a mitzvah, and it has this stronger statement of God made the world to be settled. And that's a stronger statement which implies, according to the Briska Rav, a mitzvah for everybody, and it's considered a mitzvah rabbah, in the words of Tosfos, a great mitzvah, over and above a normal mitzvah. So that's one key point that we're going to keep coming back to, so keep that in mind. The other key introductory note is the question of whether you're allowed to employ artificial insemination or in vitro fertilization, as we defined them in the beginning. And there are two major halachic debates we have to address in this regard. Debate number one. Toshiner spent the last 25 minutes talking about pru urvu, you have to have children, and so on. If a person produces, if a man, actually I should say this now, according to the Gemara in Yevamos, the mitzvah of producing children is on the male. It's not on the one who does the work. The mitzvah of producing children is actually on the male. And a whole host of reasons are suggested for this, ranging from the interesting suggestion, I think it's Rav David Shapiro from the Maimonides School who wrote this, that it's out of fear that women would be seen as just producers of children if they had the imperative, and the Torah's making a statement, it's not even her mitzvah, which I thought was interesting. Another explanation that I've seen given, I think in the name of the Meshech Chachma, is that it's because she has to put herself in danger to be able to do this, in terms of pregnancy, labor, and birth, not to mention raising, in the early stages there. But because of that, she can't be given an imperative to put herself into that position. That's another explanation. There are a whole host of them. But the bottom line is, it's a mitzvah for the male. So, is there really then? We keep talking about pru revu as this mitzvah for the male. What if producing a child this way doesn't fulfill the mitzvah of pru revu? What if it doesn't fulfill the mitzvah? And indeed, some argue that it does not fulfill the mitzvah of pru revu, and the child is not even considered halachically his child. Whoa, where does that come from? So it starts with a Gemara in Chagiga, and if you thought the one with the Eved was strange, you ain't seen nothing yet. The Gemara in source number 6, the Gemara in Chagiga, is talking about a woman who becomes pregnant while still being a bitula, while still being a virgin. Yes, that doesn't sound like Judaism, that sounds like something else off of a mistranslation of the word Alma in Yeshaya Perek Zion. Nonetheless, the question is asked, is it possible for a woman to become pregnant and the hymen is still in place? And one of the ideas that the Gemara entertains is the idea that, as you see in the translation for number 6, maybe she became pregnant in a tub. There was seed in the tub from a male who used the tub beforehand, and it entered her and made her pregnant. And the Gemara said, that really shouldn't be possible. And the Gemara says, yeah, but maybe it can. And the science behind this Gemara is not the science today. This is not the way we understand the way that conception works. And it's not the point. Because the question is not the Gemara's case of the woman becoming pregnant in a tub. That doesn't matter for us. What does matter for us is it leads to a halachic debate about the status and the relationship between parent and child in the event that the child was conceived ex utero. Outside, well, not in this case. In this case, the child is conceived in the uterus. However, not through the normal sexual act. That's the question. So that there is an authority called a Chalkas Machlokes, a prominent authority on the Shulchan Aruch, on the Code of Jewish Law, who quotes he first says, I am not sure if this child is considered the man's child. Maybe it's not his kid. And he goes into a discussion about a case which is actually claimed to have been via this sort of conception, involving a man by the name of Ben Sira. We are so not going into Ben Sira right now. Ben Sira was a controversial sage who is quoted sometimes in the Gemara with praise for his words, and sometimes the Gemara says his work is farim chitzonim, it's external material which should not be studied. He's a very interesting figure, and at one point it is claimed that he's actually the son of Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah the prophet, through this sort of conception in a tub. So, without going into the whole discussion of how this happened, just because we don't need that right now, I have enough to get through here. The point is that he is considered to be Yirmiyahu's son. And so the argument goes, well, maybe that means that it is his child. On the other hand, there was no normal act of conception. By normal, we mean sexual intercourse. It didn't happen in this case. And the Beit Shmuel argues against him, saying no. Beit Shmuel is another classic commentator to the Shulchan Aruch, printed on the standard page in the Code of Jewish Law, in the section dealing with issues of family life, Evan HaEzer. And he argues that the child is his kid, and he says, I'll prove it to you. We have a concern about women not getting themselves into a position in which they could indeed conceive in this way out of fear that they won't know who the father is, the child is going to grow up and end up marrying his sibling without even being aware of it. Well, that's why is that an issue if you say that the child is not considered to be from this father? Clearly, the child is considered to be from this father. And the Taz, all this debate goes on in the 16th, 17th century when no one is doing IVF and no one is doing artificial insemination. But the question fundamentally is, a child who is born without a sexual act behind it, leave out the question of how that happened and the science of it, because it doesn't matter. The question is the sexual act necessary in order for paternity to be established in halacha? In Jewish law. That's what we're asking. And so all the cases that people looked at for centuries and said, why are you asking this question? This can't be. They were just born too early. Because in our day, yes, it can.
The Igros Moshe cites this for suggesting that if you have a donor, it has to be a non-Jewish donor.
Well, that's we're going to get to that discussion. Not at length, but a little bit, because you have to. So the Taz discusses this in source number 7, also classic commentator to the Shulchan Aruch, and he's really unsure. He says, maybe we consider the child to be the son of this father, to be strict, but not to be lenient. In other words, maybe we'll say it's like a doubt. And therefore, for areas where we want to be strict, such as this father has a daughter, and now he has a son this way, we won't let them marry each other. For that purpose, we'll say it's his child. But for purposes of leniency, like to say, did you fulfill the mitzvah of Puruvu or not? Maybe we won't count this as having fulfilled the mitzvah. So that's the debate. Let's move it ahead into contemporary times when now we have fertility treatments that could actually, fertility methods that could actually accomplish this. So there are indeed contemporary halachic authorities who argue that it does not fulfill pru'urvu. There are contemporary authorities. Rabbi Tzion Uziel, writing in the 1950s, took that position. The Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, was concerned about that possibility. He, in general, is the major contemporary voice against these methods. He was the one who really drew the line and said he was not a fan, although, as we'll see, he does at one point permit it. But in general, he is the one who has the greatest suspicion of it, and he's very concerned about where this goes. And the answer of where this goes is our world today, in which you can have material from one egg transplanted into another egg and then inserted into a third, into a woman, and he is very afraid of things like that and what it's going to do to the concept of the Jewish family. And that's what leads him to this great opposition. That plus certain halachic arguments. All right.
Is the kavanah that I read somewhere, during copulation, the men, what they're doing, they're drinking, they're mind, is that affected in the verse? So if someone has with the bathtub, obviously there's no kavanah, nothing. So really, it's just on a physical level, without the spiritual or psychological.
Right. Right. So certainly, if you're a Lubavitcher, not that you are, but if you are, you know that the Tanya, the question that was asked, right, because it wasn't audible in to everybody, was, is this related to the idea that when procreating, what they have in mind actually influences the procreation? And so here, there's nothing in mind because there's no act between the two of them. So the Tanya talks about this, the idea that what's in the minds of the parents actually affects the type of soul that the baby will have. And there is that idea. I don't really understand that, to be frank. On a whole host of levels, I don't understand that. But there is such a concept, which I think, you're right, I think they would look at this and say, well, what is this then? And what kind of soul are you going to get? I don't know. Julie?
So to play devil's advocate here, you can ask...
There is no devil. We haven't taken a side. Yeah.
Why does it matter to determine the paternity? I mean, like, now we live in a culture where just, like, the point is not who is your father, who is your mother, who do you live with, what's the relationship, da-da-da, how did you get here? The point is your family is the people who love and care about you and who are going to help you.
Right.
I don't know, apply to college or whatever it is parents do.
Usually pay for college, not apply to college.
Teach you how to drive. Anyway, so I get, okay, so part of the issue is we need to know if the man has fulfilled who or who, but what are the other importances of knowing who is the halakhic father and mother?
Right. So there are all sorts of reasons why the halakhic parentage is going to matter. Things like, is it a Kohen? Right? Is this kid, you know, a Kohen, a Levi? Who can they marry? Are they the siblings of this, you know, father's other children? Aside from the question of, did he fulfill this mitzvah or didn't he, which is going to tell me whether he's allowed to engage in this, because as we'll see, there are halakhic problems involved in this process. Ellen?
I don't really see how the bathtub case applies to artificial insemination, because in the bathtub case, like you said, there's no kavana to fulfill the mitzvah of Puruvu, but in artificial insemination, very clearly there's an intent to fulfill.
Good. Hold that thought, because you are with Rav Yitzchak Weiss, the Minchas Yitzchak. So hang in there, and you'll see that view as well. The Tzitz Eliezer was especially concerned when it came to IVF. He said IVF is even worse than what you're talking about doing with artificial insemination, because he says here, I wrote it for you in number 9, we're going to come back to number 8, but he says in number 9 that there's no fertilization occurring inside of her at all. It's all happening in a test tube. So he's really upset about that. Others disagree. The Menachas Yitzchak, as Ellen noted, Rav Yitzchak Weiss, disagrees, and he says, our case may be different. I didn't bring it on the sheet. He says, our case may be different because it's not automatic. It's not like the bathtub case, where it's an accident, basically. Rather, it happens through great effort. They invest in it. They go through a procedure for it. And so therefore, he says, I am not so sure that you could actually say that this doesn't fulfill Peruvu, even if a bathtub case doesn't work. And to add to that, something that we're going to come back to, we require supervision. We require that there be supervision of credible, trustworthy Jews to say, this is still the man's seed all along, because otherwise there is grave concern for mix-ups. And so he says, we don't have any doubt. In the bathtub case, you don't know who the father is for sure. But in our case, we do. So he argues that maybe the arguments against from the bathtub are irrelevant when we're dealing with AI and IVF. And indeed, Rosh Shlomo Zalman Orbach, I brought it for you in number 10, in a critical article on this, says it is indeed subject to debate, but his position is that this man does fulfill Puruvu. To which I would add that even if he doesn't fulfill Puruvu, you could still make the argument that he fulfills Shevet. Right? He is causing the world to be settled even if he didn't have a sexual act. And I thought that was my chiddush, and I was looking around for someone to support me, and lo and behold, Rav Victor Nevensal, in source number 11, took that position as well. He says, if we understand, I'm going to go with the English in the interest of time, if we understand that the purpose, or at least one of the purposes of a match, is maintaining the species and establishing generations for service of the Creator, and not only mutual satisfaction, then in my humble opinion, there is great room to say that producing seed to fertilize an egg is not wasting seed, etc. And even if the act is unsuccessful, he has acted in the only way available to maintain the world. This is somebody who couldn't procreate normally. Now, this is their way of maintaining the world. There is an element of Shevet in what they do. I'm going to come back to the wasting seed point in a moment. But just to summarize what we've said, number one, we've explained the idea of producing children as a mitzvah rabbah, not just a regular mitzvah, but having this Shevet element, which puts it over and above other mitzvot. And number two, we're now talking about whether this act is halachically acceptable. So our first question was, does it fulfill pru or avu? And the answer is that subject to debate, with strong voices saying that it does work. And even if it doesn't, you still have the Shevet element, which we call this great mitzvah, involved. But now we have to get to the second debate. And this is the debate regarding what's called Hosad Zera Levatala, producing seed in vain, because of the argument that if a man produces seed and it is not directly into the woman, this is considered producing seed for naught. I brought you source number 12, the Gemara in Nida, which says that, and this is only part of a longer Gemara, that if you look at the story of Yehuda and Tamar, right, you remember the story of Yehuda and Tamar, or you went to Hebrew school and never looked at the Parsha after that, so they didn't teach it to you. But the story of Yehuda and Tamar involves at one point a man by the name of Er, who is married to Tamar, and doesn't want to produce children, and then his brother also, Onan, does not, it's really Onan where we find it most explicit in the Torah, does not want to produce children, and he deliberately avoids impregnating his wife. And there in the Torah we are told that God is so angry that he ends his life early. And on that basis, the Gemara here says the person who does this is liable for Misa Bidei Shamayim, not in a human court, not capital punishment, but God will do it. Now, this is a whole other discussion and involves very serious issues of adolescent mental health and all sorts of other things. I am not going into the debate of how we teach this and its impact as a halakhic calculation on various areas of Jewish law. Right now, I'm only telling you that the Gemara takes this as a very, very severe thing. And the concern is it considered hotzah zera levatala? Is it considered producing seed in vain for somebody to engage in either AI or IDF? And the argument is made in particular when you're dealing with, let me do it in order. The first argument for why this is not an issue applies in the case of artificial insemination, because artificial insemination, generally speaking, not always, and I have a fertility expert here, so I have to be careful, but I think in general, correct me if I am wrong, in general, artificial insemination is indicated because of a problem with the male.
could go either way, but typically it's for male and male factor fertility issues.
Okay, so generally speaking, that's going to be the case. So I'm going to take the typical case where that's true. So you're going to say to me, you should say to me, and indeed the Menchas Chinuch says it, and that's the source that I jumped before, was number 8, it should have been over here, that in the event that the male is not able to impregnate without this, and this is the way that he's able to produce children, then how could you call this in vain? Just the opposite. In the normal course of things, it's in vain, and this time it's not. This time it's actually gonna, we hope, lead to conception. The Menchas Chinuch makes this argument, not in the context of IVF, he was a little bit, or AI, he was a little too early for that. But he says, maybe it won't apply. Maybe this prohibition won't even apply to somebody who is not capable of producing children in the normal course of things. Others disagree with his argument. Again, even before artificial insemination was a thing. It's a fascinating debate in its own right. Why would it be argued that this is in vain? Because it's not going straight from the male into the female. And that's the argument brought by Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, and that's the argument brought by Rabbi Melchiel Tenenbaum, the Divrei Melchiel. That is the argument against. However, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach disagrees. He says, fundamentally, putting the seed into her, and this goes back to the source that we saw in number 10, he says the act of putting the seed into her is in and of itself just like the sexual act. And he says they take the seed from the male and they put it into her. So what's your big problem? He argues it's not a problem. The Sridei Eish as well, Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg, argued that this was not a problem. When it comes to IVF, the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Waldenberg, is even more strict. That's in number 13. I didn't translate it only because I was coming down to the wire on Friday on this, and I had enough full pages, and I said, you know what, let me just leave it. But I have the source here for you to read, and I'm going to tell you what it says in any case. But he says, IVF is more strict than AI, than artificial insemination. He says, first of all, because in artificial insemination, the seed goes into her the same way it would in a normal act of sexual intercourse. Whereas here, it doesn't ever go into her, right? It's to conceive in a test tube, and then the embryo is what's going to be inserted into her. But the seed never enters. That's concern number one. Number two, he says, when you're even if it does work, he produces a quantity of seed, and they use a certain number of sperm, whatever it is, to fertilize the egg, but the rest of it is going to get thrown out, as opposed to in a normal act where it's all going to be used.
It's also an issue for sperm testing, right?
Right, so there where Shlomo Zalman says, I can understand why you might oppose it if it's taken just for testing, as opposed to where it's for fertilization, where he says he doesn't see the argument. But he says I see the argument regarding taking it for testing, correct. But he says, but Rabbi Waldenberg's last point that I bring here is that in artificial insemination, the husband is the problem. When you're dealing with artificial insemination, the husband is the issue, and there's the room to argue, therefore, that this is not in vain, like I said, from the Menchas Chinuch. However, not always the case, but generally the case. In IVF, though, you're often solving a problem that is occurring within her. So you're getting him to produce seed in order to solve a problem. That's not the problem within him. The problem is actually her biological issue. So that's why this becomes a greater debate. Is this an issue of producing in vain? So we have two major questions. One, do you fulfill Pur Revu? And number two, is this Levat Tala? Is this in vain? The third point is raised by all the sources, and it's a very serious problem. And that is the question of supervision and trust of the physicians. The Divrei Melchiel and Melchiel Tenenbaum pointed out that there's an incentive, in fact, to potentially mix in one sample with another sample. What if there's a sample and the physician knows he's only getting paid for success? I don't think that's the way it works. But let's say he knows he's only being paid for success, and he knows the sample that he has a low chance of succeeding. So maybe he mixes in from another donor where he feels like he won't get caught, and now he has a higher chance of succeeding. And even if he doesn't get paid only for success, he gets a better reputation. He has a higher success rate. So that's the concern. Now, all ethical physicians are horrified that someone could allege this, but we have a history of suspicion of the profit motive.
It's actually happened very recently.
Great. You're supposed to say, no, this never happens.
Somebody was sued. It was in the papers.
In Ottawa.
Okay, there we go. Ottawa, right next door. They, so great. Now we have corroboration of the problem. But we've always had suspicion of the profit motive. It comes up in kashrus, right, where we have concern for substitution of kosher meat, non-kosher meat. This is why we require hashgacha. We require that there be proper supervision. And so, indeed, everybody who permits this, all of the authorities who discuss this, insist that there have to be proper methods in place. That's why they're more suspicious of IVF than AI. Because in artificial insemination, even if they're going to wash the seed or do something to it, it's relatively close in time. With IVF, there could be a very long period of time. And who is supervising to make sure that nothing happens and no samples are switched and no mistakes are made? So they require that there be procedures in place to ensure that it'll be properly done. In practice, the halachic authorities who permit include Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, include Rav Avadia Yosef, including Rav Yosef Shalom Al-Yashiv, but they all permit only where this is your last resort. You've tried other ways, it hasn't worked, and there's a fear that they're going to lose their opportunity. It's causing strain on their relationship. There is psychological trauma because they see all their friends having children and they don't have, and this is what they've always wanted, and so on. They say, okay, then they're okay with it. But it's not the automatic yes that I think people often assume. It actually requires a lot in order to get there. I brought you some of this, or I brought you Rav Avadia on it in source number 14, and his insistence on close supervision, and that it should be where there is no other option, and so on. Now, there's a whole other question I'm just going to mention, but not go into. I see you, Julie. But I'm not going to go into in depth because the interest of time just don't allow it. Maybe if we do a part two at some point, I'll come back to it. And that's the question of who is the donor. It's one thing we're talking about where it's the husband and the wife and their materials, and that's generally speaking what is specified that you require it to be from the husband and wife. Could you have a stranger? Well, that raises a serious problem. The Torah says that you are not allowed to put your seed into a married woman. And that's the wording that the Torah uses. L'sitein shechav techa. You shall not put your seed into her. Does this count? If so, that means this child is a mamzer, is an illegitimate child, unable to marry most people, and so on. There's concern as well when you're dealing with a stranger as the donor for potential incest among the children. If this child ends up marrying a sibling, and lest you say, well, what are the odds of that happening? If you're dealing with the era of sperm donors who are giving multiple times to a bank and the increasing popularity of IVF, it becomes a greater possibility that people in the same region come from the same person, right? You grew up in Toronto, you live in Toronto, you get married in Toronto, and you stay in Toronto. Well, guess what? You may have a sibling who did the same exact thing. And you may never know that they're your sibling. I've actually seen it suggested, having a third party who is in the know about the donors and their children in order to avoid this problem. I thought that was a really interesting solution, sort of an escrow party.
There are registries, actually.
There are registries. Okay, so that would seem to help with this problem. Another question that comes up, could you have a non-Jewish donor as opposed to a Jewish donor? Someone mentioned this already before. Rav Moshe Feinstein, in order to avoid the problem of potential incest, did say in a case of great, great need, maybe this could be permitted. And whoa, did he get attacked for saying that. The general trend among authorities is to prohibit. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach wrote in his article, which I've already referenced before, he discussed the halachic implications for the status of such a child. Rabbi Yeshua Neubert, one of his leading students, said that was never intended as, go do this. It was just what would happen if somebody did this, what would be the status of the child, not that it was written. Remember, keep in mind, his article on this was written in 1958. It was not intended as a guide to what to do. Julie.
So, in terms of the supervision, how does that work in practice? I mean, as soon as the husband finds the sample, he needs to follow it. They follow it into the lab and watch what goes on in the lab and then follow it back until the time.
So generally speaking, what's done is that there's actually a separate authority who is present to be in charge of this. Yeah. There's a mashgiach. So, okay, we've now done our two major introductory questions. I have to be out of the room at 10:15 because they need to set up for a meal. So, therefore, we need to make sure that we get moving on our three vignettes. So, our first vignette, I'm going to sum up what I wrote there. You can see it though in the first source where I list the questions. Is the wife in a couple obligated to go along with this in order to be able to produce children? So we have two separate calculations. One is financial and the other is physical. From a financial perspective, keep in mind that these tend to be expensive. In Israel, it may be covered by the government if you go to certain providers, but in general, this is an expensive procedure. So if the man is fulfilling Purur Revu with this, he's fulfilling his mitzvah, so we know you have a mitzvah of spending, you have a rule of spending up to 20% of your assets to fulfill a mitzvah saseh, to fulfill a mitzvah. So the argument could go, he has to spend that in order to fulfill this mitzvah. What about for her? What about within her? So if we accept the idea that she has a mitzvah of shevet, of settling the world, which we hinted at already before, with the Briska Rav idea that everybody has this concept, then maybe she has a mitzvah of Shevet also. Rabbi Yaakov Ariel deals with this. One of the interesting questions in Shut Pua that's addressed is the question of whether a couple is allowed to use their Meiser money, their Tzedakah money, for the sake of this. I'm not allowed to use my Tzedakah money to fulfill a mitzvah that's incumbent upon me. Right? If I have a mitzvah, I have to pick up a lulav. I can't use my Tzedakah money to go buy a lulav. I might be able to use it to support someone else to get a lulav, but I can't use it for my mitzvah. So paradoxically, they're better off if it's not her mitzvah, because then she can spend her money in order to, she can spend her tzedakah money and call it tzedakah to enable the husband to fulfill the mitzvah. But more important than the financial calculation is the point that there is great physical exertion involved here, and there's even danger involved, as there always is in procedures. And I think that's what drives Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach with his statement in source number 16, the Nishmat Avram quotes Rav Shlomo Zalman to say there is no duty for a childless couple to undergo IVF in order to be able to produce a child. Rav Yaakov Ariel in Shut Pua says the same thing. There is no obligation. Is it a good thing? Assuming it's permitted at all, if we take the view that it's permitted, then you're fulfilling mitzvah rabbah, great mitzvah. Is it obligatory? Absolutely not. That's our first question. Our second question. So, I first made this a very narrow question and then realized that it didn't pay to make it a narrow question. It really needs to be broader. And that's what so I brought you a piece of the Shut Pua question. A religious couple living in the U.S., he's 43, she's 42, they don't have any children, they've been married for 9 years, they want to undergo fertility treatments, and that requires all sorts of procedures, and the timing for it may require Shabbos. Now, in Shut Pua, they point out that in Israel, you can actually arrange everything with the hospital to be on a non-Shabbos, non-Yom Tov schedule. They can work it all out, you can time the ovulation, you can get everything to work. However, if you're working here, you may not have a compliant hospital or fertility clinic. I don't know if yours will help.
I always write down my protocols if it's important to the patient. Avoid Saturdays as necessary. I mean, if we're not preventing ovulation, it's going to sometimes happen.
Okay.
And there are organizations to help with arranging that they can stay nearby and they, there are ways around it.
So there are some who actually do help with this to make sure that it'll all work out. What if it doesn't work out? What are we able to do on Shabbos? What are we not able to do on Shabbos? And this ranges from doing a urine test to test for ovulation. There used to be a thermometer test, which I'm told is not really used anymore because it's not considered that reliable to test body temperature. But the urine test for ovulation, injections that may be needed, at different stages, taking the man's sample, putting the sample into her, all these different questions. What are you allowed to do on Shabbos and what are you not allowed to do? That's why we spent a lot of time on the question of, is this a mitzvah rabbah? Is this a great mitzvah overriding other things? Or is this a run-of-the-mill mitzvah? So that's one of the questions. But actually, even before we get to that question, we have to ask this question. What is the status of a couple who are undergoing fertility treatments? Are they considered in any way, shape, or form ill? Now, I gave you sources on the sheet reminding us of the general categories of people who are sick and what may be done for them on Shabbos. So the first category is somebody who is in life or death illness. You can't really say that here. The argument could be made, someone who is in great psychological trauma such that it's going to break them. But I would make 2 points, and there is actually, I brought a source on your sheet, source number 17, that suggests that for great psychological pain, there is room to make such an argument that could be pikuach nefesh, saving a life. However, I'm not a fertility expert, and I'm not a psychologist, but I would say that if someone is at that stage with this, what they need is not pregnancy, what they need is counseling. And I think that that's something that I say not glibly, but I say very seriously, like that has other calculations involved. However, you can make the argument that this is what is called sakanas aver, danger to a body part. Some of the people here were at my Monday night series when I used to do Nishmas Avram on Monday nights and at Shari Shemayim. And there we talked about this category of sakanas aver, danger to a limb. The conventional way to understand the category of danger to a limb is like somebody has a broken bone and there's fear that it won't heal right if you don't do something on Shabbos. You know, so it's damage to somebody's eye or something like that. However, that's a very narrow explanation of sakanas aver, danger to an organ. If you take, I use the word organ, really aver has no translation in English. It doesn't mean organ, it does not mean bone, it does not mean limb. It's a word for certain parts of the body that are defined in a Mishnah and Ahalos. Some of them are organs, some of them are bones, some of them are limbs. So don't try to extrapolate. But the key point here is that in terms of what constitutes danger to a body part, danger to an aver, the argument goes that it's not limited to, I'm trying to see if I have one here. Yes, source number 18, Rav Neuberg. Actually, I did bring it there. He says, there is room to say, Rav Neuberg is the author of Shmir Shabbos Gehilchasa, which is considered to be one of the most authoritative, if not the most authoritative, digest of the laws of Shabbos in our day. So he says, there is room to say that danger to an aver is not only regarding a human aver from one of the 248 avarim, for any distinct component of the human body, regarding which there is concern that if we're not treated now, it would cease to function. This is called danger to an aver, such as a woman's womb, which is supposed to birth children, and if they would not treat it appropriately via medication, they would be concerned that she could not conceive. In other words, the normal function of a womb is supposed to be to produce kids, and if she can't, but you have treatments that could make her able to, that's called danger to an aver. That's really important, because, as I note here, and in the next source, in the Shulchan Aruch, some will permit violating a rabbinic prohibition in order to spare an aver on Shabbos. You could violate a rabbinic prohibition, ideally with a shinui, do it in an unusual way, but even without the shinui, even without that change to it. So if you believe that that's true, that this is called sakanas aver, danger to a body part, you would be allowed to you would be allowed potentially to violate a derabanan for the sake of these treatments. This is a minority view, but I state it because it's an important view. I should note an important limitation, though, by Rav Avigdor Nevensol in source number 28, which is, no, it's not a number 28, I take that back. It is,
22.
Is it the one I brought in 22? Yeah, it is 22, thank you. In source number 22, Rav Nevensol says, you have to distinguish between two types of treatments. Some treatments make the body part work. Some replace the body part. If it's replacing it, that doesn't qualify as treating for danger to an aver. I'm going to actually go straight through at this point to make sure we get to the material. But the next category is one that is supported by many halachic authorities, and that is chola she'en bo sakana, a patient who is not dangerously ill. Examples of this are somebody who is bedridden due to a high fever, or somebody who has a migraine headache on Shabbos, someone who is in that category where they're not going to die if they go untreated, but they're in great pain or disability. And in such a case where somebody is in this category, the Shulchan Aruch, as explained by the Mishnah Berurah, says you will be allowed to violate a derabbanan, a rabbinic prohibition, with a shinui if you do it in an unusual way, or you could have a non-Jew do the malacha on your behalf, asking non-Jew to do it. So the argument goes that that's the category here. Number one, because of the great emotional pain of people who are not able to have children in a society which places such an emphasis on it. We go all the way back to Rachel and the Chumash, saying to Yaakov, if I don't, Mesa Anochi, she says, I will die if I'm not able to have children. Tosfos, on a Gemara in Shabbos, talks about emotional pain. And I brought it in sources 23 and 24, and says that if somebody is embarrassed to walk among people, he's dealing with a person who has a scar of some kind. He says there is no greater pain than that. So how much more so when we're dealing with the pain that these people feel on a daily basis? And so many halachic authorities apply this to consider the couple chole she'en bo sakana, a patient who is not dangerously ill. According to Rabbi Gideon Weitzman, I brought it for you in number 25, he quotes Rav Yitzhak Zilberstein quoting his father-in-law Rav Yashiv. He quotes Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg quoting his father-in-law Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. He quotes former chief rabbi Rav Mordechai Eliyahu. He quotes Rav Yaakov Ariel, as well as Rav Ephraim Greenblatt, who was from Memphis. He passed away a couple of years ago. But these are leading halachic authorities who are willing to say that her category is Chol Hashem Bo Sakana. Rav Asher Weiss, more contemporarily, up to the minute contemporarily, says that a derabanan could be done for this couple. He has some doubt, but that's what he concludes with. So we have the idea that she's a Chol Hashem Bo Sakana. That's really important in terms of permitting certain things on Shabbos. In addition to that, though, you have a separate argument, which is, it's a mitzvah rabbah. It's a great mitzvah. This is what we call tzorech gadol, a great need. And that may also allow certain things on Shabbos. The Shulchan Aruch writes, regarding this category, I did not bring it here on the sheet, but there it is. It's in source number 26. Source number 26 on your sheet talks about lighting having a non-Jew light a lamp so that you can eat your meal on Shabbos. And the Shulchan Aruch of the Rama, I should say, Rabbi Moshe Isserle says, I am not a fan of having a non-Jew do this. However, you could have a non-Jew do something for a mitzvah in the case of tzorech gadol, in the case of great need. He's more in favor elsewhere. I bring only one source, not the other. He's more in favor of asking a non-Jew. Remember that there's a rabbinic prohibition against asking a non-Jew to do things for you on Shabbos. I should have started there. There's a rabbinic prohibition against asking a non-Jew to do things for you on Shabbos. Incidentally, that includes hinting to the non-Jew, it's dark in here, can you turn on a light for me? Yes, there are cases where such a thing is allowed, but they're much more proscribed, much more narrow than people think. Ask your rabbi for more details. But in terms of what we're talking about here, you will be allowed to ask a non-Jew to perform something that is rabbinically prohibited for you, if it's for the sake of a mitzvah or a great need on Shabbos, according to the Rama Rabbi Isserles. The Mishnah Brura quotes the view of the Shalah in source number 27, who is not happy with this idea. He doesn't like it. But there is such a view, and it's an important view, because producing children may qualify as Tzorech Gadol, as fulfilling a great need. So Rabbi Victor Nevensal, this is the one in number 28, says you are allowed to instruct a non-Jew for these things. That's a very important point in terms of how one would proceed. Rav Yaakov Ariel supports this as well. Rav Asher Weiss supports it when you're dealing with a derabbanan. I'm going to hold questions to the end at this point to make sure that I get through this. So what does this mean in practice? So particular treatments involve elements of their own. You have to know what treatment you're talking about. So injection, for example, that's not IV, but that's intramuscular, is itself relatively lenient on the scale of things. It's not like an IV one where you could be potentially at a biblical level. Taking a urine test with a strip that has to be exposed to the urine and it changes color may involve issues of tzoveya. There are an ultrasound, which involves all sorts of issues with electronic devices, electrical devices, and the issue of miseyeya. Am I helping? Am I participating in the act? Each treatment is going to involve elements of its own. But in terms of the guiding principles involved, The fundamental outcome of this, and this seems like a good time to repeat my general mantra of, for all practical questions, ask your shul rabbi, because he's the one who should be posketing for you. But it seems like asking a non-Jew, certainly for a rabbinic prohibition, but potentially even for a biblical permission, for a biblical prohibition, would be justified in order to be able to produce children, either because of Chol HaShein Bo Sakana, or because of Mitzvah Rabbah, or some combination thereof. That's what I would say as of now. The last point, the last question. Single mother wants to undergo IVF, or for that matter, artificial insemination, I suppose. But I gave you a case in source number 5 that's taken out of Shut Pua, page 250. There are all sorts of cases like this. The question comes up not just for a single mother, right? The question comes up, what about for a couple in which it's 2 men and they want to be able to have a surrogate? What if it's 2 women and they want a sample from somebody in order to be able to produce children? And so on and so on. What is our attitude towards creating children in this scenario in which they don't have the standard, traditional, conventional nuclear family that Judaism has generally wanted? So there are 3 points in favor of saying go ahead, but no one will ever permit this. The 3 points that are in favor of it are, number one, the idea that women are commanded in Shevet, which we've already mentioned, but I brought you the Magen Avram, Rav Avram Gambiner, saying so, that women are commanded in Shevet. He's dealing with the question of selling a Torah to enable a woman to get married who otherwise could not get married. And he says the women have the mitzvah of Shevet, and therefore it's justified for you to do so. The second reason to do so is the deep desire for children, which we have already noted from Rachel, and you can bring numerous halachic sources that bring this as a significant factor. The third is the Gemara in Yevamos, which talks about a woman whose husband does not want to have children, and the idea that you could actually force him to divorce her in order to be able to produce children, because she wants someone to take care of her in her seniority. She wants to have a child who's going to take care of her. That's a reason to have children. So for those 3 reasons, you could argue, why should this single woman lose out? However, there are very significant reasons why halachic authorities don't favor this. Number one, there's an issue called shtuki. In source number 30, I brought you the line from the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch writes that if you have somebody who doesn't know who his parents are, that person is only able to marry somebody who converts into Judaism. Because of concern for mamzer, you don't know if he's marrying a sibling. You don't know if he's marrying somebody he's ineligible to marry because you don't know who the parents are. So only somebody who is new to Judaism, right, you get rid of all the family concerns, all the Kohen concerns, all the various issues that you may have, that's the only one who's going to be open to this person to marry. So much so that if they did marry, the Shulchan Aruch says, you dissolve the marriage. Not when they married the ger, but when they married in another way. So that the Sridei Eish and others are very concerned for this. I saw a tshuva, a response somewhere, the woman who wanted to have the child said, well, what if we use one of these registries? So that we'll know who the parent is, and therefore we won't run into this problem with the marriages, because she was aware that this was indeed a concern. There is a sort of heter b'dieved for this. Rav Ovadia Yosef says, although he's not in favor of this in practice, but he does say, in the event that there was such a child, and in the event that the child got married, you could note that since most people are kosher, so to speak, for this person to marry, right? Oh, yeah. Let me not go into it. He comes up with a way that it can work, but you still have grave concerns even if you solve that problem. The idea that if you publicize this as an option, it's going to weaken what we want as the ideal family structure. And it's true, as Julie pointed out before, that in contemporary society, that structure is gone in many circles anyway. Nonetheless, it is assumed within Judaism that this is what we want to have for the child, that the child is better off having the father and the mother. And, you know, call it closed-minded if you like, but that's one of the arguments. Another argument is that people won't necessarily know that she had the child from IVF. Right? All they know is that a single woman in our neighborhood who suddenly has a child, How did that happen? And the concern is that it breaks down social boundaries surrounding issues of having children out of wedlock, because people are going to assume that there was some issue here, some kind of extramarital involvement that led to this. And the argument is this good for the child's future? Because everyone is going to know in the community that this is the kid from the woman who didn't have a husband, and they know that it wasn't that she was married and divorced or whatever it was, and people do talk, and people do remember, and therefore there's a concern for that as well. And again, you could make the argument that in many communities this is no longer such an issue, but in the Jewish community, in the Jewish world, this remains a factor. So they ask this question here. It's page 250 to page 279. They ask this question of 11 leading authorities from a range of identifications within Orthodoxy. So people who most people would identify as Haredi, people would identify as less so. And down the line, they all came out against it. Rav Menashe Klein makes the argument saying that the Gemara in Erevin says that it's bad to be brought into this world. That's the Gemara in Erevin, right? The classic debate, Beit Hillel Beit Shammai, is it Hillel and Shammai or Beit Hillel Beit Shammai? I think it's Beit Hillel Beit Shammai. The debate of whether it's better or worse for a person to be born. And the conclusion is, better not to be born. The soul was better off where it was before, but now that you're here, you should do good things. So he argues, if this child is going to be raised by this woman alone, he says that's not going to lead to good things. It's going to cause stigma for the child. It's going to cause all sorts of problems. There are limits on who the child can marry. You haven't done this child a favor by bringing the child into this world. There are those who argue about where it's going to lead. There was a remarkable question that was asked as a practical question. It's mentioned in here, or I saw it in a tshuva elsewhere. There was a woman who worked in a home for the developmentally disabled, and she wanted to have a child from one of the developmentally disabled people who she was taking care of. And it was going to be her chesed, and she knows the risks of having a child who's going to have these same problems, and she's actually hoping for that. She wants to have that as her life of chesed, that she's going to raise such a child. And it creates all sorts of very serious ethical problems having nothing to do with Judaism, just general bioethics. And is that really the right thing to do? So really, everyone who he asked, Rav Menashe Klein, Rav Greenblatt, Rav Victor Nevensol, the Nishmas Avram in Ben Ezer has his own discussion about this. They're all not in favor of pursuing treatment for a single mother to be able to have a child. It's painful to say that, because you read the question and you realize this is a woman who desperately wants to bring life into this world and to raise a child, and she's given up hope of being able to do that in the context of marriage. It's a very painful thing, and I feel bad, you know, having to give that stark a response. And I feel like it's glib to say, you know, well, we should be making more efforts towards shiduchim. We should be making more efforts towards shiduchim. And it's glib to say, well, she could adopt a child, because adoption is not simple and straightforward. But that seems to be the state of where things are from the various halachic authorities, is a strong discomfort with this idea of pursuing such treatments. Let me just ask them, what time is it? Because I don't have the time on here.
10:03.
So we have like 10 minutes until they forcefully kick us out of the room. So I just want to summarize very quickly, and then I'll take questions, and those who have to leave can leave. But we talked about the mitzvah of producing children as not just a general mitzvah, but as a mitzvah rabbah, a great mitzvah, with the caveat of, do you fulfill it through AI or through IVF? We asked the question of whether these things are halachically acceptable. Does it fulfill Pururu? Does it fulfill the mitzvah? Is there a concern for Hatzad Zera Levatala, producing seed in vain? Plus the issue, which apparently is a very live and current issue, despite all the protections in place, the concern for substitution of seed, of the samples, or I suppose even of the embryo. Once you go into that stage, you can have a mix-up of the embryos as well. So we noted the debates on all of the above. What we ended up saying is that serious halachic authorities do permit this as a last resort, and with supervision to make sure, rabbinic supervision, to make sure that the samples don't get mixed up. We said that there is no obligation for a couple to go these routes to be able to have children. In terms of Shabbos, there is a strong view that says that she is considered, or the couple is considered, chola she'en bo sakana. A person who is ill, just not dangerously so, and therefore perhaps you could have a non-Jew do whatever is needed, whatever malacha is needed, in order to be able to pursue these on Shabbos, although there are options, in Israel certainly, but apparently even here as well, for timing things that you don't have the Shabbos problem. And then the last issue, the issue of pursuing treatment for a single mother, despite the points in favor of fulfilling Shevet, of her own pain and her deep desire for children, and her need, perhaps, to have a child who's going to take care of her in her old age, nonetheless, halachic authorities are staunchly against permitting this, as painful as it is to have to say that. Questions? Dr. Libman.
Are artificial insemination for a couple where there's male factor that is attractive?
Right.
Want to get somebody else's sera.
Right, so that goes back to the question of whether you're able to use seed from somebody else, which I referenced it as a topic, but didn't want to go into it in depth. I think if I do a part two, then that will be one of the things that we deal with in depth. But the short answer is that most halachic authorities are against having it be from somebody else because of the concern that it renders the child a mamzer. Rav Moshe did have the potential leniency where there are no other options if you use a non-Jewish donor. And again, he was hit over the head for this, so much so that he wrote two responses to them. In one of the responses that he wrote to them, he said that I understand the opposition to what I'm saying, and I would like to have support from others. I think that's what he wrote in his first response. His next response is controversial because of the question of attribution. Did he write this, or was this written on his behalf? It's already when he was much older. In which he says, I heard what they had to say, and I already responded to them, and they're all wrong. It's a much more sharp answer. Thank you. If you didn't sign in, by the way, please make sure that you sign in, both for follow-up on this class and to get notification about future classes. So please make sure that you do sign in. But that would be what I would say right now on that. Other questions? And again, if you have to leave, you should please. All right, Julie, David, and then Ellen. Yeah.
Yes. So in the case of, let's say, you posited that a Gentile has to perform some aspect of treatment, is it also there a way to argue that that's very embarrassing for the couple? You know, you go up to marry your neighbor. Hi, I'm trying to get pregnant, but I can't, so I need to do a Gent something because I can't do it because of my religion. Like, Mary's going to think you're crazy.
Right. You don't need to tell Mary that it's because of your religion, you know.
No, but then Mary is a good neighbor, so say, oh, you want me to fight every day and you'll be your infection.
And you say, no, I'm squeamish today. You come up with an excuse. That's a practical question, an implementation question. And you're right, that it's fundamentally uncomfortable to involve a third party whose business this is not to get involved in your procedures, you know, and to know how you're having your child. Not to mention when. But in terms of the injection actually is one of the easier elements.
Or like another thing. The fact is, it's a treatment that you cannot prevent.
Right. So what you would be better off with is something that I think Michael mentioned before, which is the possibility of staying near the facility on Shabbos, and then you have the professionals who are managing every other stage of what you're doing be the ones to take care of this as well. You're right that it's a question, but I think it's a question that can be solved. David.
Yeah, you touched on donating the sperm for testing. Situation where a couple is genetically compatible, they both carry some hereditary gene. They want to have a baby together. So a solution that's offered to them is in vitro fertilization, that both can donate their respective eggs and sperm, and then each can be tested to find a cancer that produces a healthy embryo.
Right.
And then implant the embryo. Is
Right, so we discussed this. We had a class, I think, yeah, the question was where they know that they have concern, the couple has a concern for a genetically transmitted disorder. And so what they want to do is have each side donate multiple samples, and then they can figure out which ones do not carry the problematic gene and create something out of that. I think we had a class on genetic screening, and we talked about PGD last year on it. And noted that there are concerns. The question of what do I do with the other embryos? Do you freeze them? Are you allowed to dispose of them? And so on. But there is endorsement broadly for PGD in the case that you describe. As opposed to I want blue eyes or something like that, where it gets a little more thorny. But there is halakhic discussion of this that I'm not prepared to address in a sophisticated way right now. But if you go back on YU Torah, you can find the genetic screening shear, and I think I did have a discussion of it then. Ellen?
Just a philosophical question. This idea of it is better not to have been born seems to be in direct contradiction to the whole Pur, Vuh, and Shevet.
Yeah, isn't it? Ellen asks the question. If you're telling me the Gemara in Erevin concludes that it's better not to have been born, why in the world did God say, I want you to produce life? I have to ask Beis Shammai that question.
Isn't there a Kohelet?
Oh, we have many. I mean, Kohelet would be the ideal place to look. Even as L'Erval Tanach Yodeh, is also there. But the question of how to understand this philosophically, and I'll go with the mission of Pirkei Avos, and you're born against your will, and so forth. The answer could well be that there are things that are painful but worthwhile. In other words, you're not doing a favor to this child, to bring this child into this world, in the sense that life is going to be difficult. And it's going to involve pain, it's going to involve challenges, and for this child, perhaps more than most. At the same time, that doesn't mean that life is not worth living, and that's what the Gemara's answer is by saying, you're here. So, Yifashish Ramasov, check your deeds, make sure that you're doing good things. And Pur Ravu is saying, life is worth living, even if we believe that there's an element of pain in having been brought into this world. I'm going to stop with that because they really do need to set up the room for the lunch. For the questions, we can talk outside. Thank you very much.